The end of the week and a busy day on Radio 1. I'm Louise Herity. It's Friday the 7th of May and here's what's coming up on Playback Daily.
You know, in this country, we swear for the same reasons everyone else does. Like, you know, there's any amount of reasons why people need to swear, you know, like to let off steam, to convey a strong emotion, to add colour.
I think what I describe menopause as waking up one morning and like an autoimmune disease, your body starts attacking itself. And not only is it mental, but it's physical. So there you are, this woman, all on your own, at war with yourself.
So we're going to go down to Clare on Thursday. I'm just really excited to see them.
Well, there's definitely some positivity and hope in the air as we get closer to Monday, with the easing of many restrictions, including inter-county travel, being permitted. And on Morning Ireland, Ayla Sheehy spoke to people about their plans for next week and beyond.
When my mum told me first when I was going to go to Clare and see my cousins and all my family, I thought she was joking, but she didn't really have a joking look on her face. I was so happy. I miss them a lot, my granny and granddad. Whenever we are down there, they're like a good entertainment. They're good fun. So we're going to go down to Clare on Thursday. I'm just really excited to see them.
10-year-old Kira Broggy Duffy hasn't seen her 16 cousins in Meelick, County Clare, for over 20 weeks. But that is about to change. Restrictions on inter-county travel will be lifted on Monday. And on Thursday, Kira and her parents will set off on their journey from Monaghan to Clare, a trip they have been longing to take for many months. Kira's mam, Bridget Amelia, can't wait to see her parents in person again.
My mother is 73 and my father is 79. Noel and Bridget Brubby. My mother and father have a farm, so they have loads of different animals, geese and ducks and dogs and cats and kittens. And so all the cousins have great fun going walking around the farm.
So now that your parents have been fully vaccinated, do you plan on meeting them indoors when you go to Clare at the weekend?
Yes, hopefully we'll be able to go up to them and go indoors, because my mother's a great cook. She always cooks fabulous dinners.
And my granddad, he's really good at making pancakes.
They're great entertainers, great hosts. They're always feeding everyone, so it's brilliant.
22-year-old Kaya Flynn from Castlemaine in County Kerry is eager to hit the road and drive beyond her county boundary for the first time in a long time.
I haven't left the county since last July. I also wanted to make the most of my insurance that I paid for, which was over 1,000 last year. And obviously I couldn't get that far with it. So being able to get out and explore and see what Ireland has to offer would be a big plus for me.
You have plans to visit Cork in the near future?
Yes, my boyfriend has been living in Cork for the last couple of months because he started work placement in Skibbereen. And he's been telling me all that Skibbereen has to offer. And so we have planned a trip up there and just getting out for a hike. Who knows, we might even go into the museums and the art galleries now that we have the opportunity.
My name is Sandra McDonnell and I live in a beautiful part of the country near Cloughhead in County Louth. I'll be able to celebrate my first grandson's first birthday the following weekend. So we're able to go down to see him in Maynooth and I'll be able to get my hair done for it. So we can see our grandson with his other grandparents and I'll have a nice head of hair.
A much-needed catch-up over a cup of tea in a friend's garden is another priority for Sandra.
Somebody we knew unfortunately passed away over the last about 6 weeks ago, and you can't go and comfort somebody just standing over a gateway. So it'll be lovely to go into them and sit with them or closer to them outside with a cup of tea and sort of give them your full attention instead of wondering whether or not you're doing anything for them over a gateway. So it'll be a lot simpler and a lot easier and a lot more real being outside, sitting with them and conversing closer to them.
Donna Moore from Enniscorthy, County Wexford, will make a very important trip to Dublin on Wednesday. It has been a year and 4 months since she last saw her best friend Fiona Cooney, who was travelling to the capital by bus from her home in Tipperary for a very special reunion. A lot has happened since they last met.
I would have loved to be able to have seen her, to be able to tell her that I was pregnant, so having to tell her over the phone was not the way I would have planned it. So I was nervous kind of doing that because I wanted to be around her and give her a hug. And we had a little tears and stuff like that. Because it is a big thing for me as much as it is for her, I guess. like, I mean, she was there for my wedding, which was a milestone in my life. And now I'm having a baby, and to be able to share this experience with me now is going to be great.
And Fiona, what's the real in-person experience going to be like?
Very surreal. I'm sure there'll definitely be tears. And like that, it's still going to be somewhat hard because, you know, I have to keep my distance. I can't give her the big, huge hug that I would love to, because, you know, we still have to be very cautious. But just to be able to look her in the eye, it just feels like we've won some huge prize, the fact that we get to do it. I'm so excited.
Fiona Cooney ending Éilis Sheehy's report on Morning Ireland. Now, despite restrictions easing, there's still guidelines about visiting homes. And on the News at One, Gavin Jennings spoke to Colm Henry, the Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE, and he asked him what people should and shouldn't do when they meet up.
First of all, it's a time of great happiness and hope, in contrast to what we faced in the past year. And it really has been a terrible year, particularly for those people at high risk and particularly for older people, where so much more was asked of them in order to protect them from this horrendous virus. So the first message I have for people out there and we are now seeing a situation where over 700,000 vaccines have been given by the GP community to the over 70 population, and 60% of this population now fully vaccinated. The first message I have for them is the vaccine gives them great protection, even more than we would have hoped for in terms of the trials. So just could give you two brief figures, Gavin. Look at cases over 75 years of age. Only a few short months ago, almost 7,000 in 1 week alone. In the last week, 212. Hospitalizations in those over 65, 2,700 in the first 4 weeks of this year, 138 the past 4 weeks. The first message I have for them is the vaccine is giving great protection, even a short period after the first dose. And this is a time of great hope for them.
Okay, so they're looking for what sort of protection it gives them when they receive people into their house, unvaccinated people into their house, which in many cases is going to be their children or their grandchildren. Can they hug them?
Yes. Well, I would say we are asking people still to maintain those safe practices of social distancing, mask wearing, and hand washing. The vaccine does not get rid of those other public health measures, but the most severe public health measures that cause the greatest pain. Column.
So when, I mean, people are making plans for this. So say, for example, you've been fully vaccinated and you're about to have your children or your grandchildren come to visit you. Who's wearing a mask? Who's not wearing a mask? What should they do?
So we're encouraging people to stick to those public health measures. The people who are vaccinated have a much, much greater reduction or reduced chance of becoming sick or hospitalised as a result of this. Perhaps 90% or more after two doses, and certainly 80% or more in some cases after the first dose. It's not completely reduced to 100% reduction, but it's much, much greater.
Are you advising them to wear masks when they have visitors coming?
I would advise that insofar as is possible. Obviously, each family has a family bubble and people want to get together, and I can understand people want to hug their grandkids. And of course,
do you think they can?
I think for small family bubbles that can be recreated, keep small numbers of people in your family bubble. Of course, that can include grandkids. Of course, people who have missed their grandkids and have had no contact with them will want to hug them again.
And that's okay?
I think what I would advise to people is keep
your
social bubble small.
Hard to keep your distance when you're hugging somebody. No, do you think it's okay?
I think it's okay, provided you keep a small number of people in your social bubble, and that's going to include your grandkids well and good.
Fully vaccinated, and I know Tony Houlihan set out the definition last week, a revised definition for what fully vaccinated meant. It meant 1 week after you'd received a second Pfizer, you can correct me if I'm wrong on any of this now, 1 week after a second Moderna vaccine, 4 weeks after a first AstraZeneca vaccine, and 2 weeks after you'd received a Johnson & Johnson. But as you've already outlined, there's a lot of protection available even after a first dose of a vaccine. So all the things we've just been talking about for people who've had a first dose of a vaccine, who are about to visit their friends, about to visit their children, their grandchildren, are they safe to do all those things?
Yes, because there's more evidence coming through, Gavin, all the time. We're not just relying on that phase three evidence on tens of thousands of people. We're now seeing real world evidence that even after the first vaccine, admittedly a number of weeks after in case of the AstraZeneca vaccine, there's a big reduction in severe illness and hospitalisation. And there's evidence coming through that place you want to get to of reduced transmission, of reducing asymptomatic illness. Big evidence coming through from multiple trials that the vaccine actually protects against asymptomatic illness and transmission. So this is a time of great hope for people, even a critical time after the first vaccine. And the message we have is better than we even would have wished for a couple of months ago.
Because there are many people who've spent over a year now being very, very careful for very understandable reasons. They've taken on board the messages and they've also seen people that they know get very sick and in some cases have lost them as a result of COVID. And they're worried about what's going to be asked of them and expected of them next week. But at the same time, they're really looking forward to seeing people. After a first dose of vaccine, you're saying that it's OK for them to start welcoming people back into their houses again.
After the first dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine, if you just get this clear, is because we recognise that the gap between the AstraZeneca vaccine, the first dose and the second dose, is 12 weeks or sometimes up to 16 weeks. But we now see that those people, after 4 weeks after that first dose, should be afforded the same advice and same guidance as people after that 1 or 2 weeks, depending on the vaccine you get after the second dose. And that's in recognition of the fact that otherwise they would have had to wait a long time for the second dose to get that same category. If you like. And let's face it, people have suffered a lot, as you outline in your questions to me. They've suffered a lot. And we're very aware of the secondary harm that's ensued, not just for older people, for children too, in terms of what was asked for them the past year. And there's time to start catching up on that secondary harm.
For the vast majority of us who haven't had a vaccine yet, but are now able, or at least the guidelines suggest, that we can welcome people into our gardens. Three households, isn't that right, into our gardens from Monday. What would your advice be on what we can and can't do in those circumstances?
My advice is very clear. Is that we may change. We may change our emotions. We may change from hope to despair. The virus has never changed its capability. In fact, it's become more transmissible, if anything. And we see from other countries such as Chile, very far ahead in terms of vaccination program, but somewhat of a mismatch between the easing of restrictions and the coverage of vaccination of the population, where we saw a collapse in hospitalizations and ITU of vaccinated populations. But for people who are unvaccinated, we saw higher levels of hospitalization, higher levels of ITU following ease of social restrictions. So I would ask people who are unvaccinated, yes, it's a welcome time. The summer is here. Get outside, get fit, avail of all the new guidance which allows us that ability to interact with each other and enjoy the fresh air and avail of the summer. But be mindful that the virus has not changed, and nor is it going to change until you get vaccinated.
Changes to the vaccine plan, we'll hear them, the final results of them, next week. Will people under the age of 50 now be offered AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Certainly. We want to, our aim in this vaccine programme is safety, efficacy, effectiveness and pace. Get the vaccine out and get all the stocks that are being delivered to the country out as quickly as possible. We certainly don't want to see a situation where the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, a single dose vaccine, where we have stock we can't use next month, that if it could be given safely and effectively to another population. So we're waiting. Those discussions are ongoing.
Is that what you expect to happen?
Well, we just have to wait and see. Those discussions are ongoing this week. I expect an early answer out of this, but certainly I know there's a combined intent for all of us to roll out the vaccine quickly and effectively and safely to all age groups.
Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE, speaking to Gavin Jennings on the News at One. Later on today with Claire Byrne, the presenter was joined by actor and comedian Ard O'Hanlon, whose documentary Holy F is on this Sunday night on RTE1 at 9:30.
I watched it yesterday. I laughed out loud. One of the things that grabbed me straight away, and I kind of knew this about you anyway, you're not mad about swearing yourself.
No, funny enough, like, I don't particularly swear a lot on stage. Probably off stage I do. But I always sort of set myself the technical challenge of not swearing on stage.
I loved what Tommy Tiernan said to you. Now, when you swear on stage, like, oh, this is really serious, it's like your dad swearing.
Yeah, but you see, when you use swearing sparingly, it has greater impact, isn't that the thing? But I do find myself swearing, like, when you're under a bit of pressure on stage, like if you're trying out a bit of new material or something and you don't have much confidence in it, you might throw in a swear word to give it extra punch. Or if you're in a sort of a hostile atmosphere, you might swear a bit more to grab attention. So, you know, it's all about context, really.
Yeah. And then that point you make, which is so valid, if an Irish person goes to a different country and swear like we swear in Ireland, it's quite shocking, isn't it, for people in England?
Yeah, well, it is and it isn't. Like again, I would find in England, you know, it's kind of expected of us, whether that is sort of like whether they're patronising us slightly or whatever, I don't know. But I think the way Irish people swear, it's not aggressive or it's not confrontational. Mm-hmm. It's just part of the everyday speech. And I think, like, you know, we explore, you know, this subject from loads of different angles. One of them is the way we style ourselves in this country has been relatively classless, whereas in England you've got rigid class structures. So people do mind their P's and Q's. People are very prim and proper in lots of situations.
unlike us. We're not. We kind of reckon we're classless, which of course isn't true for a second.
That's the conversation you have with Frankie Gaffey, the linguist, where he was saying that we use that language, bad language sometimes, as a leveller, you know, that we're all on the same page here.
Yeah. We're very informal in the way we conduct our everyday speech and our transactions, you know. And Hazel Chew, the Dublin's Lord Mayor, made a really good point. And, you know, like most of this documentary, by the way, is very speculative. It's just us riffing on because there's not an awful lot of research, particularly in the Irish context, about swearing. But she made a really good point, and the science does bear this out, is that swearing is very unifying. So it's a way into a group. And she, as the child of Hong Kong immigrants, cheerfully admits to swearing like a trooper, really, and that it was a great way of assimilating as a kid.
Yeah.
And she makes the very clear distinction between that and the kind of slur words that are thrown around that are designed to hurt you and to exclude you.
Yeah. Interestingly, another thing I really liked about it was that the point was made that Father Ted made the use of the word feck acceptable. Will we just have a listen to a clip?
The language, unbelievable. Feck this and feck that.
Yes, Mrs. Doyle.
You big hairy arse, you big fecker, fierce stuff. And of course, the F word, Father. Bad F word. Worse than feck. You know the one I mean?
Yes, I do, Mrs. Doyle.
F you. F your effing wife. Oh, I don't know why they have to use language like that.
Do you agree with that, that Ted made it acceptable?
I think it was always around, wasn't it? I mean, you know, it's a great entry-level swear word. We all use it every age, every social context. You know, and it means something else in Ireland. So it kind of, like, you could even say motherfecker and it's not offensive.
Mm-hmm. When you change the E to a U, that's when you're in trouble, right?
Yeah, so it is a euphemism. Like, and you see, the point is that you need swear words. So even people who don't like cursing and swearing will often say things like feck or jeepers or geez or gosh.
Oh gosh, I tried to say in front of my children and they raised their eyes to heaven.
The point is, Claire, like we've always had this reputation for swearing. Like it goes right back. You know, William Carlton had a famous essay on swearing and he said that, like, you know, Irish people, every oath is epic, full of humour, pathos and the highest order of invention and talent. So we've been swearing for a long time. Joyce, in his letters to Nora over 100 years ago, absolutely filthy.
Yeah.
Even by today's standards, shocking altogether.
And some of our swearing isn't meant to be mean or insulting, is it?
No, it's part of everyday banter.
Like I think you can probably say the B word that comes after lanky and lazy, but I probably wouldn't get away with saying it. But I liked what you were saying, that you can just using that as an adjective is okay. It's not that offensive.
Yeah, it's a term of affection often, you know, like the way we use swearing, you know, it's all about, like, when you trust people, that's when you can swear freely. And that's when you know you belong. Like it's really interesting. I mean, you know, in this country, we swear for the same reasons everyone else does. Like, you know, there's any amount of reasons why people need to swear, you know, like to let off steam, to convey a strong emotion, to add colour and emphasis.
But did you get to the bottom of why we swear more, or do we swear more than other nationalities?
That's the big question, which, you know, there is no research in that. So there's no evidence. It's just that we think we swear a lot more than other people.
I'd say we do. Do you think we do?
Oh, I think we definitely do. And everyone I've spoken to thinks we do as well. And you know, a couple of the reasons I would put forward for that is, like, we do have to go back to our history of colonial oppression over centuries. You know, when you don't have any money and you're disenfranchised and you're humiliated time and time again and you have no recourse to justice, all you have are your words and your imagination.
Mm-hmm. This listener here doesn't trust people who don't swear. If someone yells sugar when they drop a hammer on their toe, that person is hiding something.
Yeah, I wish that person was in my documentary. No, absolutely. Like, I mean, it's absolutely necessary, you know, and you have a physical reaction when you swear or when you hear swearing. You know, it's a kind of a fight or flight response, you know.
And Tommy then, his conversation with you about swearing, like, he loves cursing, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Even in his interview with you, he's relishing in the words and the sound of them, and he makes them sound so good as well.
Absolutely, and that's a big part of it. I mean, I think Tommy is a great artist by any standards, and I think he represents the way people really speak. So he doesn't censor himself in any way on stage. He speaks the same way as he would off stage.
So then how does that play into you not cursing on set the stage? Are you censoring yourself?
I'm just a prude, Claire. that's
but
me.
But you see, you said you grew up in a house where nobody was swearing at all.
Oh, yeah.
So it depends on how you're rare. It depends on how you were reared.
Well, it does to a certain extent. But then you go to school and like at the age of 4 or 5, you suddenly hear these very bad words that you were kind of warned about.
Mm.
And you realise the power of them. And so then you try them out for size yourself.
Yeah.
Before you know it, you're...
Thinking about the other day in our house, the broadband wire came down and the children ran out to me and they said, the broadband wire came down and Daddy said the F word, which was the best part of the whole story. And it struck me in that moment that in telling them these are bad words, don't say them, we add to their power so much, Absolutely. Don't we?
Yeah, we do indeed, yeah. And like, I came across this great quote, I think it was a writer called Emma Comerford, like, you know, and I'm going to mangle the quote, but it's about like the best way to become the most favourite child in the house is to start swearing at a very early age. And I mean, we all love it. Like some of the most popular YouTube clips of all time are little kids swearing inappropriately and adults rolling around the place laughing.
I know. What is it about? It's like you'll make a call to the grandparents and say, guess what she did today?
Yeah. But you know, it's always been part of our culture. And we have a great contribution from Mancon McGann, who kind of tells us about how, you know, in Irish, which is a very colourful language, you know, with a very rich vocabulary, there was always this amazing tradition of heaping curses on your enemies.
Oh, you know, terrible things,
you know,
yeah.
May the devil use your back as a ladder and things like that.
We have a good example of that because that was the clip that we played a little bit of earlier on, but let's hear all of it now. You spoke to Professor Salvador Ryan, great name, about this idea that historically it was believed that poets had the ability to curse people through their work. And this was his example. It's from the 17th century.
Fevers brack, a scholar, pastor, bulgock, vocus, bulgock, enert, cusk, fool, is nisca, clavered, scurvy, cri, is galler, nonaired. Which roughly translates as may you have typhoid, may you have hookworm, may you have swine flu, may you have bird flu, may you have difficulty in urinating, may you have a breast ulcer, may you have scurvy, is galler, nonaired, may you have liver disease. Now, when he's finished with that...
It beats your own ear bollocks.
Exactly.
It's just terrible. This is what Moncom is saying to you as well about this thing. But I wanted to talk to you about that, the distinction between swearing and using slurs.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like that is a different programme and I'm probably not the person best qualified to do that show, you know, about slurs, where you're victimising people and marginalising people. I mean, it's incredible how taboos have changed over the years. Like, effing and blinding is really very acceptable now in Ireland today.
Mm.
Like, people don't really bat an eyelid. But people would get extremely outraged and offended by any of the slur words, like where you're demeaning people, you know, based on their race or their sexual orientation or their size or any of those words. Good example of that would be an obvious example, Fairy Tale in New York in 1987, on Top of the Pops, the offensive word was arse. And that was...
And they bleeped it.
They bleeped it, absolutely. 20 years on, it's now the word that gay people find offensive beginning with F.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even say it on a radio show today.
Yeah.
Which is fair enough. I don't have a problem with that. It's just that, it's just incredible how quickly these words change. Like the words we bandied around in the playground as kids, not realising the harm that we're causing. You know, you wouldn't think of using today, I don't think.
Yeah, so it's evolving all of the time. This listener hates swearing. It makes me feel very uncomfortable. Most of my friends feel the same. And my son thinks it shows a lack of ability to communicate or express themselves. Now, Bob Geldof in your documentary has exactly the opposite view.
Yeah, he talks about the musicality of it and, you know, that like... And a few of the contributors sort of made the point that it just adds colour and rhythm and punctuation. I think Bob mentions that, you know, this various studies have been done about, you know, some people think that swearing shows a lack of intelligence, and it is quite the opposite. It kind of suggests that you have a wider vocabulary. I mean, I go back to James Joyce,
mm-hmm.
you know, probably the foremost novelist of the 20th century with probably the widest vocabulary of anyone who ever lived.
What do you think about that theory, though? I mean, if you had a wide range of language, surely you wouldn't be using the words that are going to offend.
Well, I mean, sometimes they're the only words that will do. You know, it's like, for example, if you're watching the news and somebody comes on the news who really bugs you and you're outraged and you're offended and you're disgusted by these people, in the privacy of your own home, you're probably going to use a very outrageous expletive to express your what you think about that person. Sometimes that's the only word that will do. Like, you can't call him a cad. Oh, you cad. I completely disagree with the housing policy. You know, that's not the word that's appropriate in that circumstance.
And again, Bob Geldof goes back to that famous example of him during Live Aid, where on live television, he asked people to pick up the effing phone.
Yeah.
And the effect that that had.
Instant impact. It was like, as he said himself in the documentary, it was like a slap in the face. Up to that point, you know, everyone was enjoying the music, all the bands doing their job, but no one was sending in the money. And so Bob made his intervention, and instantly, the money started rolling in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a reason for it. It's not like that we just do it for the crack. No more than like this documentary, I don't think is gratuitous in any way. And I think it's a genuine inquiry as to why we do it. We do it for a reason. We've evolved this way.
Because you mentioned class earlier on, and there is an idea that bad language is working class language, or there was at least, and we'll explore that more in a minute. But I just want to play this clip. It's a piece from Roddy Doyle's The Snapper.
There you are, Desi. How's it going?
You keep your hands off me.
What's wrong with you?
You know pretty well what's wrong with me. You were saying things about Sharky.
No, you've got it wrong, Desi.
Wrong, me bollocks.
No, honestly, I swear.
Me bollocks.
There's great power in that word from Georgie Burgess. What? Well, that was from Sharon's dad. What was Sharon's dad's name? Georgie Burgess was the snapper's dad.
Remember.
I've ruined the film now for everybody.
Yeah.
But
watch it again.
You didn't find in the course of your exploration that it is a class issue.
I don't think so, not in Ireland. I mean, you know, there was, like, certainly growing up, you know, there was this idea of respectability and propriety and, you know, knowing your place and your position and all that.
But and then the word that you won't go there, the C word. You wouldn't say it in the documentary, and other people did.
Yeah, I mean, I'm uncomfortable with that word myself, mainly because of my daughters. I probably used it a lot when I was a kid, but, like, my two daughters, you know, they absolutely despise that word.
Yeah, I hate it. I hate it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, you know, we had a great contributor from the UK, an English scientist called Emma Byrne, who explained why that word it's really been contested over the last few years. And it's because of the advent of social media and stuff like that, where it's been used weaponized and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of these words, of course, are reclaimed. So, like, you know, the N-word being reclaimed by black people, you know, and the C-word being reclaimed by women. So when men are using it, it's become a little bit kind of... But then, you know, the thing about the word and the power of that word, I think, is very much the sound of that word. And I think I go into a little bit of detail about the actual linguistic reason why a word like that becomes the ultimate taboo word.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, with the you know, the technical terms plosive and velar and, you know.
Well, look, the whole thing is fascinating. And thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about it. We didn't use bad language in the end, did we, really?
No,
neither
of us.
We're too prudish.
I'm very respectable.
Ardal O'Hanlon with Claire Byrne earlier, and you can see Holy F on RTE1 television this Sunday night at 9:30. The menopause has been a huge talking point on Lifeline for the past few days, so no surprise it got people talking again today. And Joe Duffy opened the show with a letter from a listener, Mary.
Dear Joe, I am 70 years of age. I've had the most miserable life over the menopause. I used to enjoy sex until I started the menopause. And I'm not ashamed to say this, but I haven't had sex in 30-odd years. It finished my marriage because I had no interest whatsoever. I am still getting hot flushes. I have to plan ahead what to wear. It all has to be linen or cotton. Due to mind fog, I lost my job. I was an accountant, and honestly, I couldn't think straight. Just to be able to wear clothes comfortably would be a dream come true for me. I would love a few years of some normality now. I will try anything. We didn't talk about this stuff 30 years ago, and we just got on with it. But I have to try something to change this.
And that was Mary, as read by Sinead. Carmel, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Your story, please.
Well, thank you for highlighting this issue. I describe menopause as waking up one morning, mm-hmm. and like an autoimmune disease, your body starts attacking itself. And not only is it mental, but it's physical. Mm-hmm. So there you are, this woman, all on your own at war with yourself. And it's a very, very silent war. Mm-hmm. And I found, Joe, over the years, when I spoke to other women about menopause, they either blanked me as if to say, no, no, we can't talk about menopause. Mm-hmm. Or number two, women were in denial, i.e., sorry, I'm too young to be going through the menopause. And it's, I feel now that menopause reflects the end of your life. You're no longer fertile, you're not going to have any more children, and you're automatically old. So you get menopause and you're old woman.
Even though for most women it happens when they're around 50, and that is the end of their lives.
The end of their lives, you're an old woman, step off the battlefield. And nobody is discussing it. And I suppose what happens is it's the mental thing more than the physical thing. Mm-hmm. Your brain starts playing tricks with you. And can I give you an example?
Yeah, of course.
So I have, I'm at work and I see a colleague cutting a tomato, okay? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I don't like the way that colleague has cut that tomato. So I leave it, let it go, I say. I go home, I think about that tomato. And I might even mention it to my husband. And I'm sure he's saying, yeah, there's crazy balls again. Then I go to bed and I'm exhausted. I'm absolutely exhausted. I go to bed. I get into bed, pull the covers over, and I'm just about to go into this beautiful deep sleep. When all of a sudden, bing, I've been put into a pizza oven at 500 degrees. And obviously you put the leg out, put the arm out. Yeah. But guess what happens then? Because you can't sleep. Mm-hmm. What does the brain think about? The tomato. And you become obsessed about it, and you spend all night obsessing about it. And you wake up the next morning, you're over the tomato, but you'll move on to something else.
And in terms of help, Carmel, has anything worked for you?
Help as regards, I think the biggest help in the whole world is women talking about it, I have to say. Because people go through different phases, and I haven't tried HRT, and I've tried to do it by myself. But I find women should talk to women about this. It is not a taboo subject anymore. Yes, it's embarrassing sometimes for ladies, but it should no longer be embarrassing, and we should maybe try and put a bit of humour into it now.
And I presume, Carmel, I presume if you're having a hot flush, that which doesn't at all describe what we've been hearing over the last few days, but that's the term that's used. If you're having a hot flush, would people in your workplace notice?
Well, because I discuss it among my colleagues, yes, they would, and you'd step out. But I've seen customers where my heart breaks for them, absolutely breaks, like one lady described yesterday, where the sweat is rolling down their foreheads and onto their eyelids, and they're blinking. It's a horrific thing to observe. Mm-hmm. And it must be horrific for women, as that lady would say, she can only wear cottons and linens.
Yeah.
Your whole life revolves around how you're going to dress. And when you get a hot flush, the way your neck and face flares up, it's embarrassing and it knocks your confidence. Of course it does. And you don't seem to join in with that fun anymore because you know you're going to get scorching hot if you exert yourself anyway.
And Carmen, you mentioned other women talking about it. When you say it to other women,
yes,
what's the reaction?
I'm talking about maybe 4 years ago when I mentioned menopause. I got this blank stare as if, my God, how could you talk about menopause? Nobody talks about menopause. Just don't discuss it. The end.
Wow.
And especially, and then other women, which is quite funny, and I don't mean to be mean, but other women deny a menopause because they don't want to be branded as old. Menopause seems to think that you're an old woman now.
Yeah.
And it's not nice.
That was Carmel, just one of the many callers to Liveline this week sharing her experience of menopause. It might be the 7th of May, but it certainly doesn't feel like it weather-wise. And earlier, Claire Byrne discussed the bizarre weather we've had this week.
Well, it's been an absolutely bizarre week of weather. At some point in the last few days, most people will have looked out the window to lovely sunshine, followed by hail 5 minutes later, not to mention what we were doing here, defrosting the cars in the morning, and it's May. So what is going on? Alan O'Reilly is with us. He manages the hugely popular Twitter account for weather watchers, Carlo Weather. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Claire.
Now, we know that we can experience four seasons in one day in Ireland. We accept that, OK? We know that that's the case. But it is May and this weather is really odd.
Yes, it's certainly been a very cold start to May, and we're more familiar with April showers that bring the May flowers. But unfortunately, the May flowers are getting the brunt of some very cold, as you say, frosty weather. It got down to -4 degrees at Roscommon yesterday morning, which I think looks to be the coldest temperature we've seen in May for nearly 40 years. So it's certainly been a very cold start.
Oh, so we're not imagining this, right? This is a real phenomenon this month and this year.
Yeah, well, actually, it's continued from April. The coldest April ever on record at Dublin Airport, which has a record of 78 years. So we had the coldest average temperature at Dublin Airport in 78 years, and it's continued into the start of May. So it has been very cold. The frost has been causing a lot of problems for fruit growers and for gardeners that have been out covering their plants and their trees, and even some of the farmers covering acres of potatoes, unfortunately. So it has been unusual. And then, as you say, you've been waking up to blue skies and lovely sunshine, but you go out, it's very cold, and then, you know, you might decide to go for a walk at lunchtime and you look out one window and there's blue skies, and all of a sudden then you get hit by a hail shower because unfortunately that cold air has been causing some instability, which has been producing these very heavy showers, and they're very localised as well. So you could be chatting to someone over the road and they'll tell you it's the sun is splitting the rocks, but unfortunately where you are, you're getting hit by hail showers.
Yeah, and of course across the country there's been disparities as well, because I'm sure we've people in Kerry listening to this morning saying we had a great April. Didn't they have temperatures of 21 degrees in some parts?
Yeah, and funnily enough, the warmest temperature in April was on the 1st of April, the very first day, as you say, Valencia and Kerry, southwest, hit 21.2 degrees, which I think we'd all give a little bit up to get back to 21 degrees. But it was a very unusual start to the month where we had some warm temperatures. But then, as I say, the coldest in the east. We had that easterly wind. So while the people in Kerry maybe were out in their shorts enjoying the fine weather, the people on the east coast in Dublin were looking for the big coat, because the temperature with that easterly wind certainly felt cold. And while it will, you know, turn a little bit milder for the weekend, it's not going to be pleasant, unfortunately.
Okay, I got caught in a hail shower the other day walking around RTE here, and they were hard, proper hailstones. Because I know you were talking about the sort of soft hail, the grapple, is that what you call it?
The grapple, yeah. Grapple. Which is snow pellets. Yeah, and a lot of people were messaging me reporting grapple, but it was actually hail. I think we've all become so familiar with the word now that we kind of, anything that looks a bit like it, rather than people assuming it was hail, it's gone the other way around now.
Yeah, we are actually seeing proper hailstones in May.
Yeah, and you can get hail pretty much any time of the year, but I suppose what's kind of making this is that it's feeling cold even without the showers. And, it, you know, it is very frustrating for people that have been trying to get outdoors. And I suppose we're all talking about, you know, being an outdoor summer and living outdoors. But it's very hard when you're sitting there, and it's lovely one moment when the sun is shining and then the cloud comes in and all of a sudden it feels really cold. I mean, temperatures yesterday, the highest temperature was only 13.6 degrees at Mount Dillon, where it was -4. So, you know, it has really been struggling to get up to anything what we would kind of consider normal May weather.
And of course, Alan, you've been tweeting about this because everyone wants to know what the weather's going to be like going into the weekend. But a lot of people are watching the weather tonight, in particular for Darkness Into Light, the Pieta House fundraising walk. There won't be a big crowd of walkers because of COVID restrictions, but there will be individuals doing that sunrise walk in their social bubbles. So what kind of a morning are we looking at?
Yeah, unfortunately, Claire, a lot of people are messaging and it's looking very wet and windy. We have some very wet and windy weather arriving into the southwest about 8 or 9 o'clock tonight, and that's going to move up across the country. So between the hours of 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. or even 7 a.m, it's going to be wet and windy, really. So if you're going out to do the Darkness Into Light walk, you're going to want to have the rainproofs on. It's not going to be pleasant, unfortunately. Some very heavy rain early in the night in the south as well, with a risk of some spot flooding and some very strong gusty winds. It will improve, so if like most of us, you're staying in bed until sunrise, it'll be nice by the time you get up, because that will pass through. But unfortunately, unlike this morning, you're not really going to see much of a sunrise tomorrow morning.
And can we read anything into what's happening now? I know meteorologists always say we can't see that far ahead. We can only go by what we're seeing on our charts that are coming through and our various instruments that we use to read the signs. But are there any indications from what you're seeing as to what the summer might look like, Alan?
Yeah, as you say, they're very difficult to really forecast long term. It does look like it's a little milder for the weekend, but it does look like temperatures are going to drop back a little bit again next week, and we're going to have those showers again. really and truly looking at the longer range weather models, if you do kind of take any heat from them, they don't show any great heat coming up until the 20th of May. So maybe at the end of the month. I would remind people that the meteorological season of summer doesn't start until the 1st of June. So from a meteorological point of view, we haven't seen the start of summer. So let's just hope that summer does bring some summer weather.
Okay, well, the 1st of June is the start of summer. A good reminder of that, because I think we all sort of look at May and think we're there already, but not quite given the hailstones. Alan O'Reilly from Carlow Weather. Thank you very much for joining us. Nice to talk to you today.
So we're pinning our hopes on June, but don't get the summer wardrobe out just yet. Callum Geary and his twin brother Donica stole the hearts of the nation on The Late Late Show recently when they spoke about the challenges facing deaf children in Ireland. And since then, it's been a particularly busy time for Irish Sign Language teacher Jenny Healy, who chatted to Ryan Tuberty this morning.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
Are you well?
I've never been better and I've never been busier. Thanks to yourself and The Late Late and, of course, the Geary family in County Cork for just sharing their story and I think educating just so many about how we need to learn Irish Sign Language and just embrace, yeah, our country's third official language. So I work as a sign language teacher, so it's been a busy, busy week, as you can imagine.
I'm delighted. I noticed you on Instagram because you tagged me on one of your things saying that you were going to be doing a sign language course for people by way of introduction. And I thought, this is exactly what Callum was trying to achieve through his appearance on this on The Late Late, but also his dad came here first and then we chatted about it all. And that interview was very, I found it very moving at a personal and a professional level. Did you see it as it was happening?
I did, Ryan. And everywhere I've been this week, you know, with the families that I work with that have deaf children, the schools that I'm going into, the companies that I'm on Zoom calls to, every single person has just been talking about The Late Late or heard Andrew's interview with yourself. And they achieved just that, the reaction from people. So I have an Instagram page called Sign with Jenny, where I just put up kind of sign language videos for the general public and for my TY students to keep learning sign language and, you know, how to introduce yourself. And like so many, I was so moved by the Geary family story. I work with families just like them every week in Wicklow and Wexford. So I, you know, I'm doing sign language classes all day, every day, Monday to Friday. So I just put up a post after The Late Late saying, you know, I'm going to put on a Zoom class for everyone and anyone. You know, if you were inspired by this story and you want to learn the sign language, you know, give me a message. And the reaction was just, I mean, 50 people on the Zoom call last night. We actually had Callum's twin brother, Donica, who's my
good.
Say,
yeah, great
what
kid.
What a remarkable
yeah.
young man yeah. and what an example he is, you know, how to support a deaf sibling, you know, just how effortlessly cool he was signing and speaking at the same time. But we actually had his primary school teacher, Orla, from Cork on the Zoom call as well. So it was brilliant. And we actually recorded a short clip at the end just to say, hello, Callum, and we're learning ISL. And I was in touch with Andrew. I emailed it on to him this morning. So hopefully he got to see it before school, or he's a nice surprise when he gets home, just so he can see his story and, you know, letting so many people in and opening people's eyes to why so many people need to learn and embrace this language. Truly has inspired so many. And, you know, that's not just for myself. That's sign language teachers across the country have just been inundated with emails. What can we do? How can we learn? How can we support?
I'm so happy and heartened to hear this because it's taking the ISL story a little step further. A small step, but I hope an important
yeah.
step. And when you did a Zoom class on this week, did you get good recruitment for it? I mean, was that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm running a course in June, a beginner's course, and thankfully so many people last night were like, we loved that, sign us up. But like for anyone listening across the country, we have so many services. You know, we have deaf clubs and associations, we have the Irish Deaf Society, we have Chime. I mean, the best way to learn a foreign language is to get out there and meet deaf people. They're the native signers. That's how I would have learned the language when I studied in the Centre for Deaf Studies in Trinity College Dublin. And you'll see for yourself how much it means to a deaf member to see someone outside of their community taking the time out to learn about their culture and to learn about their language and making an effort to converse with them.
One of the most beautiful sounds in the world is a baby's first mama, daddy.
Yes.
Gurgle of a word. If a non-verbal child who will never be verbal is deaf, what is the equivalent for a parent with that baby.
Yeah, so we have, yeah, their first sign. And that's probably, to be honest, one of my favourite parts of the job, because we have something called the ISL Home Tuition Scheme, which is covered by the Department of Education, where you'd go in and meet a family that have a deaf child and teach the whole family sign language every week. And it's just, you make such bonds and connections with those families, because 90% of deaf children worldwide, they're born to hearing parents. And so, you know, that's the first time they're learning sign language. This is a whole new world to them. And it's been fantastic. I've been there times in the house now prior to COVID where you see the first sign. At the moment, it's all over Zoom the last year, so I've been seeing WhatsApp. So the exact same thing, the first sign might be mama or dada or bird or cat. I've had a few babies that actually sign light for the very first time, really? Because deaf children are so visual. It's a great way for getting a deaf baby's attention and switching on and off the lights, because wherever they are sitting on the floor in the room, they're going to turn around to see where their parent is and they'll do the sign for light. So yeah, there's been a couple, but more milk is usually a popular one as well.
And but they're signing it with their little hands.
They're signing with their little hands. So we have what we call kind of baby sign language. I mean, the sign for mother and father is a little bit more complex. So they'll sign mama and dada on their cheek. And just like babies, when they don't say mum and dad, you know, articulately perfect, yes, when they're younger. And then as they grow, they learn how to do the sign properly. But it's the exact same. It's that excitement. And it's, I guess, for a lot of families, it is a new chapter and it's a journey that you weren't expecting, mm-hmm, when you find out that your child is deaf or hard of hearing. And I guess when you see them communicate and sign back for the first time, you're just like, we've got this. You know, it's just a language. That's the only difference. And, you know, so many people that learn it are like, wow, I can't get over how much I'm enjoying it. And, you know, I'm picking it up so much quicker because, yeah, I mean, I'm doing this now since 2015 and I just love my job and I love the language.
I can sense that and I love your I love your passion. But why did you, and it sounds like a strange way of asking this, but why did you bother?
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you've asked this, because especially for young listeners listening in, there's a course in Trinity College Dublin called Centre for Deaf Studies, and it's a 4-year degree programme. And that is open to everyone and anyone. A lot of the lecturers in Trinity in the Centre for Deaf Studies are deaf, so really highly intellectual, the PhDs under their belts. Some of the students are deaf or hard of hearing or CODAs, so children of deaf adults. But then there's people just like me that had no link to the deaf community. You know, I didn't have a deaf family member or a friend. I grew up, I guess, seeing artsy news and the signing and was fascinated by the language. I knew in sixth year that I definitely wanted to go into a career working with children. And this was a new course in Trinity. And I just got lucky. I got into the course. And I guess I had a very different experience to my other pals in college, because Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, you know, there's no talking. You had to use sign language, because if you're a hearing person going into that course, you're entering the deaf world and the deaf community, and it's up to you to pick up sign language as quick as possible so you can communicate with your peers and lecturers. Mm-hmm. So you finish that 4-year degree, you know, fluent in sign language. So that's where interpreters and sign language teachers would train, and we're all across Ireland now. And so I cannot recommend it enough. That's why the TY courses I love that I do, because I just want to get out there and, you know, tell other younger people about this course and this whole community that we have on the island, that it's open to anyone if you've an interest in it. And you won't regret it. You make friends for life. It's a small course. There's only about 20-25 per course. And yeah, it's a job that I've just been very lucky to get into, because it's something I just love getting up every day to do.
And do you hear differently to me? I mean, if you spend your day signing... No, I mean that in the sense that if you spend your day signing and then at the end of the day, you're back into the world of hearing. Do you have a more heightened sense of hearing?
Yeah, I definitely noticed it in college. Like, you go 9 to 5 where you're signing all day.
Yes.
Even at lunchtime, like at break, you know, there's deaf people in your course. You have to keep signing. You know, it would be rude to be talking. You know how to converse in ISL, so that's why if you know it, you use it. So you'd be doing that all day, and then I'd get on the Dart back home to Greystones, and yeah, like, it'd be the first time I'm hearing noise during the day, and it could be the first time that I'm actually, you know, you'd see a friend on the Dart and you start speaking. So that definitely took a while to get used to. Sure. But I kind of work with so many different families now. I go into a family where, you know, the whole family are hearing and there's a new deaf baby, but then I also go into other families where the parents might be deaf or grandparent might be deaf, and I mean, not much work to do there. Like, I have a young boy in Wexford, and He's got deaf parents, and it's just extraordinary to see him. He's only four, and seeing his level of ISL. And I'm just really there to kind of bridge the gap for when he starts school and doing games, and just have another person in his life to be communicating through ISL, because I think what the Geary family captured so beautifully, we need children in this country to know we have so many deaf people, and we have so many people, hearing people working in this community, you know, and there's so many jobs that you can do, and it's a job in demand. I mean, we need more interpreters and we need more teachers. Like, I'm based in Dublin and I work in Dublin, Wicklow, Wexford. I mean, the last year, a lot of the home tutoring classes have been approved to go online, which has been brilliant over Zoom. And for the first time, I've been able to take on families in Donegal, in Kilkenny. But I know myself and other sign language teachers in Mayo, in Cork and other parts of Dublin. You know, that has been actually really, really beneficial, because we're able to reach families that vitally need to learn this language.
Did you get a lot of people signing up for your free Zoom who had never intended to learn one bit of ISL, or never thought it would be in their zone at all?
Yeah, I had a mix. I mean, yeah, some of the stories I could say on online today, like, some people are like, I work in a bank and I have three deaf people that come in and I've always wanted to learn, and I saw this and was like, I saw the late, and it's like, right now is the time to do it, that when they come in, no, next week on Monday morning, I'm able to sign good morning and I'm able to ask, how are you doing? And so there was a lot of people that had personal reasons, but then there were so many people, and that's what the late did. You know, you don't need to know a deaf person or be working with a deaf person. Just learn it. Just show that solidarity and support to the Irish deaf community, and we will create a country that is, you know, where children can go into the shop, they can go to, you know, wherever they are during the day, but they can bump into people. Because, I mean, and I completely agree with what Andrew Geary was saying. I was on to him this morning when I sent him that video of the Zoom call last night, that we do need to get it on, as part of our curriculum. If you go to other countries, you know, children are learning sign language. It's part of their curriculum. They know about the deaf community. They know how to converse with deaf people. And not just schools. I mean, companies have been fantastic. Like, I'd work with companies usually that would have deaf employees and, you know, the hearing staff once a week are doing a Zoom coffee call. Solace is an example. They're a further education organisation. And for the last year, they've been learning sign language to converse with their deaf employees. But particularly in the last week, there are companies that have no deaf employees that are just like, let's do this. Let's sign up. Let's make our work environment this inclusive place that if we do have a deaf person wanting to apply for a job in this company, we're ready to go. They don't need to explain that they use ISL as their first language. They don't need to explain about their community and culture, because that company has already been upskilled about it.
ISL teacher Jenny Healy on The Ryan Tuberty Show. Finally, the Darkness into Light annual fundraiser for Pieta House takes place in the early hours of Saturday morning. Despite no official events this year, thousands of people will still walk in their bubbles around the country to support the campaign. Amy Ní Riada had this report from Killarney on Morning Ireland.
This little fella was absolutely beautiful.
A character, I'd say. And we're going off the two of you.
Like his mother.
Oh, yeah.
Keep where on. Did he get the devil mint, is it?
Oh, yeah.
Look
he
at her.
Definitely brought the devil mint and the tricks in from me.
Nathan's walk is the Killarney leg of the Darkness into Light. Since 2011, it has raised over €500,000 for Pieta House. It's named after Nathan O'Carroll, who died by suicide in 2007, aged 14. I met his mum and dad, Marie and Dennis, at the Ross Golf Course in Killarney, where the walk usually begins and ends every year.
He was so cute.
Yeah. What age would he be now?
He'd be 28 now.
But he was a very happy-go-lucky boy. Great with his friends, great with his family. Even the night he died, like, he wasn't at home putting up Christmas decorations with his mother, and some of the neighbours called, and the crack was mighty for the night. So it was a total shock then when an hour later he was dead, like. It's only 'cause you're human. No control. The night of the Darkness into Light, you'd be meeting an awful lot of people in the same circumstances, and you got to talk to those people, and then you got it, the the issue was being raised and people were talking about it, whereas as years ago it was hidden. They wouldn't even be left, bury them in a concentrated graveyard. So we got involved like with Pieta over that. It's okay not
to be okay. While the annual Dawn event has been invaluable to Nathan's family in the grief process, it's also proven to be a lifeline for Pieta House in funding counsellors for anyone having suicidal thoughts, self-harming and families bereaved by suicide. Tom McAvoy is funding and advocacy manager at Pieta House.
We're aiming to achieve around 5 million. That will bring in roughly 50%, slightly less than 50% of the income we will require this year to run Pieta. So that's how valuable Darkness Into Light is to Pieta, and we really need it. So we're hoping that the community will continue to support us in that way. Certainly the pandemic has offered new challenges. We've seen a lot more challenges with high raised anxiety, especially in the last year. Since the pandemic hit.
According to Tom, COVID has resulted in a 25% increase in calls to Pieta House. Experts have welcomed the news that these people are coming forward, but also warned that more continue to suffer in silence, partly as a result of potentially burdening someone who they feel could be worse off. This exercise of comparing situations is worth avoiding when trying to deal with our own mental health, as psychologist Dr. Sabina Brennan explains.
It's a very human behaviour, so we engage in social comparison when we make judgments and decisions. It kind of results in us checking our own behaviour to make sure that we're behaving in a way that we're expected to behave. When we say something like, or go to say something like, God, I'm feeling really awful, really down, you're going to naturally compare that to somebody else, where we're kind of going, but I've no right to do this because, like, you know, I have my home, I've enough food to eat. Gosh, there's people homeless on the street. I've no right. That social comparison serves a purpose for us as humans, making quick judgments and decisions, and it works quite well. But it's not infallible. And when it comes to things like mental health, it's much more complex. They're perfectly entitled to feel what they're feeling. So that social comparison doesn't apply. And your feelings are your feelings, and they are something that you need to deal with, and there is no relative right to how bad you feel and whether you deserve treatment or support or not.
As the saying goes, it's okay not to be okay. After years of research and retrospective thinking on his own family's situation, Dennis O'Carroll says that we just have to accept that sometimes we need a little help.
Services are there to help people. If you're going to feel guilty about asking, you'll never ask, and then it's too late if you don't ask. So I would advise everybody or anybody who thinks they have a problem just to look for help. And there's no shame whatsoever. It's okay not to be okay.
It's okay not to be okay. That was Amy Nereida's report on Morning Ireland, and you can get more information on darknessintolight.ie. Well, that's all we have time for on today's edition of Playback Daily. And remember, you can listen back to any of the programmes on Radio 1 on our website, rte.ie/radio. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and have a lovely weekend.